Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organizational studies. This is Pedro Monteiro.
And this is Greta Corporal.
This is episode 58, which features the live recording from the second edition of our professional development workshop on classics of organization and management theory, held at the 17th annual meeting of the Academy of Management in Boston in August 2019.
This edition of the workshop focused on the contingency approach, a school that we previously explored in the podcast, for instance in episode 16 on the work of Lawrence and Lorsch, and episode 36 and 46 on the work of authors related to the Tavistock Institute. We organized this workshop as part of our overall goal in talking about organizations, to raise interest and generate connections with foundational ideas and authors in the field of management and organization theory. As an academic discipline, we sometimes seem too attentive towards novelty and disruption, sometimes for its own sake, while forgetting continuities. We hope that an annual workshop at the Academy of Management annual meeting is a way to inform new generations of management and organization scholars about the classics of our field and to discuss how ideas and approaches from the classics, broadly understood, can help us better understand current phenomena.
The workshop featured the presentation of three distinguished scholars talking about authors and schools associated with the contingency approach or contingency theory. The audience was made of participants at the Academy of Management meeting. Our first speaker was Sarah Kaplan from the Rotman School of Management, who talked about the work of Joan Woodward. Second, we had Gino Catani from the NYU Stern School of Business, who talked about the work of James D. Thompson, and in particular his book Organizations in Action. And third, we had Zinje Vikelsø from Copenhagen Business School, who focused on the work of the Tavistock Institute, in particular the notion of task in their work.
The next workshop will take place in the next Academy of Management annual meeting that will be held August 2020 in Vancouver. Stay tuned for more information. If you'd like to learn more about the previous workshop, including an information sheet about the contingency approach and the authors and schools discussed, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Welcome everyone to the second edition of the Classics of OMT. My name is Pedro Monteiro. I'm a postdoc at Emily Owen Business School, and together with Greta Corporal from University of Oxford, I've organized this session. Just to get things started, I just wanted to give you the program. What is the menu for the day? We are going to start. Me and Greta will give just an overview of the reason why we decided to organize this session and what is the contingency approach. Then we're going to have the presentations. We are going to have the roundtables and then just a quick plenary discussion with the takeaways from the roundtables. So just a few logistics. We'll be recording the presentations of the speakers, and they are going to be released via the Talking About Organizations podcast that Greta and I are part of. And we also prepared an information sheet that was supposed to give an overview about the continuous approach and the different schools that we'll be discussing today. And for all those who registered for the PDW, we sent them yesterday. If you have not registered and would like to receive it, we can just give you your email when we send it to you. So to start with, why a PDW on classics? As I mentioned, this is the second edition, second time we are doing that. We did one last year in Chicago that was more general, and we thought that it would be more interesting and more fruitful to focus on a specific school. And we were hoping that this is going to become a kind of a standing moment during the AOM meetings to reflect about the importance of classics. This is also related to the work that Greta and I have been doing at the Talking About Organizations podcast. We started this 4 years ago, and we have been growing ever since. And the podcast is a conversational podcast in which we talk about specific authors or papers and what is the main role that that specific classic author played and how it still speaks for today. The latest episode is about Charles Clinton Spalding. And one of the things we have been trying to do in the podcast is to expand the very notion of classics, so also introduce authors that have not been consider such before. And just a quick note, we now have a listening base of circa 15,000 listeners per every episode, so you know it's quite substantial, I think. So why a PhD in classics in light of our state of the field? You know, there have been, of course, many claims and discussions about the enduring importance of classics. Nevertheless, we have to recognize that, I think, as a field, we tend to be follow fashion and to try to end up, you know, giving more space for novelty or interesting things and sometimes forgetting a bit where we come from. So I think that's important to continuously remind ourselves, both in terms of the importance of the problematics and the approaches and the where we come from, and to understand how it still matters. And there is another reason we think, you know, this is kind of the overall classic matters, we have to study them, and everyone does that during their PhD training. But we also think that classics are not just a moment in time in which we learn. We think that's important to continuously dialogue and continuously learn and revisit these things. So that's why we wanted to do these sessions here at AOM, in which to create a space in a moment that we usually are talking about the frontiers of new knowledge, to also talk about where it comes from and reflects how these inform and better equip us. And we specifically think that they can provide a way to address some of the issues that org studies and org theory seems to be, you know, facing, specifically the what some people say is a crisis. So that's why I have the paper there, the essay there from Barley, which exactly reflects on that, on how as a field we have lost a bit of the relevance and we are finding ourselves with not so much coherence. So we think that classics are also a way to find our bearing. In light of that, we would like to start with a little postcard, and I'm going to give Greta to you to take you there.
Hi everyone, I'm Greta from University of Oxford, and as we prepared for this PDW, we approached several scholars in our field to send us some postcards, and these are kind of the digital representations of that. And this one came from Beth Betschke, actually, and we asked them, like, what is your view on the contingency approach? And yeah, here she wrote, scholars who wrote the classic works in contingency theory were trying to explain how what happened within organizations was influenced by the environment. Many of them went into organizations and looked closely at what was going on there. This is no longer as typical in organization theory, and as someone interested in organizations and what people do in them, I found this work interesting and somewhat useful. Their focus on the relationships between organizational units and our functions is important to thinking about how work gets done in organizations. I think this is a good kickoff of what the contingency approach is about. And to give you a little bit of a primer, we go to what some of the important scholars in this field have written about it. And one of them, of course, is Lex Donaldson, who we have been in touch with as we prepared for this PDW. And as we all know, the contingency approach, like why it has been important in the period of the 60s and the 80s, is drawing attention to fit, to making this fit between the organizational environment and what is happening within the organization, a focus on tasks, a focus on technologies and work processes. And where it also drew attention to is instead of this one-size-fits-all solution of what organization design should look like, paying attention to maybe specific design for different types of organizations that face different environments as well as different internal processes and structures. So that's very well written down by Lex Donaldson. And we asked him if he wanted to come to Boston, and we also received a postcard from him. He's in Sydney at the moment. He's greeting us, best wishes from Sydney, Australia. After working for many years in a contingency approach to organization theory, I'm now fully retired. However, it gives me much satisfaction to see contingency theory continuing to be of use to colleagues and students in the research. I believe it's a very robust paradigm, and I wish you all great success in your endeavors. We thought this was such a nice message we received from him. When we kind of go to the broader perspective of the contingency approach, it was kind of the start of this type of open systems thinking within organization studies, as Scott and also other scholars have kind of positioned it within the broader field of different perspectives. And here we have a Google engram that we made to see, like, you know, all the different ways contingency have been worded, like when was it popular? And you clearly see this peak between the 60s and 80s where it was very important, and the decline afterwards. And just some of the key readings within this perspective. This approach hasn't been without its criticisms. So one of the criticisms has been, like, is it really a theory? What is the contingency? Is it approach? Is it an analytical sensitivity? Also, its limited analytical robustness has been mentioned, as well as the criticisms about issues of power, emergence that has not been covered by it, as well as a more processual view. So here we have the next postcard, and I take it to Pedro.
Despite the critiques, you know, I think what is interesting is that continuous has survived, and despite the change that we see that is not so proper approach anymore, still some people are still choose do work on that. So we decided to reach out to Andrew van de Ven, who had written a more or less recent annals piece exactly trying to claim for that, to see what you have to say on the matter. And he wrote to us. In our 2013 annals chapter, Ganko Heinings, Bob Heinings, and I encourage scholars to return to the frontier of organizational science by reopening the study of continuous theory of organizational institutional design. In terms of practice, perhaps no other area of management scholarship has had such a profound impact. Organizational design has spawned and sustains a multi-billion dollar management consulting industry worldwide. We optimistically think that the sky is the limit and the future looks rosy for organizational contingent theory, because marketing science demands we put organizational researchers, perhaps groundedly, to create high-performance organizational designs for dynamically changing conditions. We also reached out to someone in Boston, Jay Lorsch, which has written, of course, importantly about, and we discovered is actually working on a book about continuous theory, and he wrote to us, how are younger scholars thinking about the state of continuous theory today? Well, stay tuned, we are just finishing a book on the topic. So we wanted to show that the approach, of course, has informed a lot and has had a decline, and for, of course, some reasons, but there is also people working on that. And as you probably saw when you were registered, we were expecting to have four speakers, but unfortunately, Bob Heinings is unable to join us. He was stranded in Montreal trying to reach here. There was a whole flight issue, so unfortunately, he's not going to be able to join us, which is a shame because, as you might know, Bob was actually part of the Aston Group, which was one of the foundation pieces of the contingent approach. And I'm not competent enough to say anything about that, but I think I would just, you know, for those who don't know, say a bit about the Aston Group, which was this bunch of people from different perspectives and disciplines that came together at the Aston, which is now at the university, but was back then a technical college. They conducted this research in trying to understand the structures of organizations in a comparative way. And they did very deep data collection with a very large sample of organizations. And they're the ones responsible for a number of our ideas about organizational structure and design. You know, they were the ones that claimed that bureaucracy doesn't only exist in one way. There are different forms of being bureaucratic and the different parameters and concepts that we still use today. These are the slides from Bob. You know, I just wanted to show you what was some of his reflections. Now we move on to the meat of the matter, which are the presentations. I'm just going to introduce the speakers and we're going to start with the first one. So first, we're going to have Sarah Claflin, who is professor of strategic management at the Rotman School of Business, who will be talking about John Woodward. Then we're going to have Sinia Vikelso, which is professor of technologies of organizational analysis at the Copenhagen Business School. That'll be talking about the Tavistock Institute. And then we're going to have Gino Catani, who is professor of management and organizations at the Stern School of Business at NYU, which will be talking to us about James Thompson. So we start with Sarah. Thank you.
So I'm going to talk about Joan Woodward, and I think she's obviously a very important figure in contingency theory and quite neglected, and I want to talk a little bit about that. The origin of this talk was a small piece that I wrote for the Palgrave Encyclopedia for Strategic Management, which I participated in because I had written a couple of other chapters on different topics. And when the editors sent around a list, because the encyclopedia includes not just reviews of topics, it also includes small bios of important figures in the field of strategic management, and there were literally no women in the list of people in the bios, and I freaked out about that, and then, of course, had to volunteer to actually do something about it, and so I wrote about Joan Woodward. And also, I should mention, I was inspired to do that because we had, at the 40th anniversary of her death, there was a special issue of Research in the Sociology of Organizations that was entirely dedicated to her, her life, and the influences of her work. So if you're interested in Joan Woodward, there's a wonderful resource in an entire volume of the Research in Sociology of Organizations, I think it's 2010 or 11. I want to talk a little bit about her role in the foundation of contingency theory. So, you know, again, the question that was just raised a minute ago was, you know, well, what is contingent on what is contingency a theory? Because it doesn't say very much about what different organization forms are contingent on. But what Joan Woodward talked about was the idea that organizational structure should be contingent on the different types of production technologies. And in her work, she identified three major kinds: small batch, which is to the customer order, large batch or mass production, and then process or continuous production. So you could think of, you know, process or continuous being more like chemical production kinds of issues. And so what she concluded, she and many of her co-authors that she worked with and her collaborators that she worked with, concluded that there's no one prescribed best practice. Now, of course, today, to our ears today, that doesn't sound very surprising, but we have to keep in mind that the context at the time of the work of the contingency theorists was that classical management theory of the time was really recommending some standard guidelines for things like what are the right number of levels in a hierarchy and what's the right span of control. So when contingency perspective or theory or approach came out, it was really going against the grain of management theory that was trying to find like the perfect formula that every company should follow. And so she was one to propose that one of the ways that organizational structure might deviate is around the kinds of products, the production technologies that you were using and that you would organize differently to do that. So the way that she came to these insights, I think, is very important to understand her career trajectory, to understand how she came to understand this. So she worked during the Second World War as a labor manager in a Royal Ordnance Factory at Bridgewater. And in her obituary, it spoke about that being the place where she gained these practical insights into industrial problems, which illuminated and became one of the distinguishing features of her subsequent work in the field of industrial sociology. So it was that practical work, actually trying to make a factory work, that informed all of her work. After that time, she entered academia, but as you can imagine, being a woman in academia in that time period was very difficult. So she did not go to prestigious universities necessarily as her starting point, or, you know, the top universities, or have the top jobs in those universities. But the concern when her first work was on post-war economic development, she did detailed studies of what work is like. So The Dock Worker was a book that came out of that. The Saleswoman, where she really tried to understand what is the daily work of different kinds of people in different kinds of jobs. She then moved to Southeast Essex Technical College, again, not a college that most of us have heard of. And I think it's really important to note that there she was sort of on the fringes of British academia, but producing some of the most important insights. And there was where the work that she did that really informed her most important, most cited works, Management and Technology in 1958 and Industrial Organization Theory and Practice in 1965. Those are the books that were produced out of her work at the time with her collaborators there. And then she joined Imperial College London, first as only a part-time lecturer, then full-time, and in 1970 she became only the second woman to be appointed as a chaired full professor at Imperial College. Her life was tragically cut short by cancer, and she passed away in 1971. We don't know how much more she would have been able to contribute, but her impact is really foundational. I want to connect her to some of the other contingency theorists or contingency perspective people and later theory. So as part of this research in sociology special issue that we did on Joan Woodward, Chuck Perow actually wrote in a piece where he said he and Lawrence and Lorsch had also been thinking about, again, these different kinds of contingencies. Theirs were much more about the different uncertainty in the environment, whether you had more or less uncertain environments. And there was a meeting organized in 1966 with Woodward, and it was only after that time that these other guys published their seminal work. So it's important to note that she was right there with them in those conversations, and they were very inspired by her work. Later, people have critiqued it as being too technologically deterministic. How can technology shape the organization, per se? But you have to keep in mind the time period when she was working, where she was just trying to get people to see that different organizational structures made sense in different contexts. Vanna Orlikovsky wrote a beautiful short essay, again in that RSO special issue, where she talked about the ways that scholars have relaxed some of the assumptions around her work and contributed in ways that continue her work around how technologies constrain and enable organizational forms, how organizational forms may shape technical systems, and how socio-material configurations are constituted and dynamically in practice. So she was able to connect the work on socio-materiality back to these original contributions that Woodward made. And I'll just conclude with some what I think are really important hallmarks of her work, things that have been very personally inspirational to me and kind of point to what it takes to come up with some radical new idea in the field. And the first is she was always first and foremost concerned about the worker on the front lines. That was where she started in the ordnance factory. That's the work on the dock worker and the saleswoman, etc. The second is that her work approach involved real engagement in the field. She spent lots and lots and lots of time in the field, she and her collaborators. And then finally, she was really focused not only on making these contributions to theory, but keep in mind the time period where she worked. It was post-World War II. It was the rebuilding of Europe. It was the rebuilding of England. It was the Marshall Plan, all of these things to try to recreate the economy after the destruction of the Second World War. And so she was also very, and maybe even more importantly, engaged with having a practical impact on economic development, creation of jobs, creation of good jobs in society. And so she cared a lot about her policy impact as well as the impact that she had on theory. So I personally find her an incredibly inspirational figure. And really, you know, I was talking to some people before, they're like, well, I've heard about these other guys, Lawrence and Lorsch and stuff like that, but never really heard of Joan Woodward. And I was like, well, there's something to do. Why was she on the margins? She was a woman working in a field where there were really, at that time, almost no women. And so she worked from the margins, ending up at Imperial College in the end. But she, from that position on the margins, she was able to make these incredible contributions. So thank you for giving me an opportunity to share some thoughts about Joan Woodward.
For the ones that are interested in hearing more about Joan Woodward, we will have an upcoming episode with the Talking About Organizations podcast dedicated to her work.
Thank you. My name is Signe Wigelsø and I'm from Copenhagen Business School, and I will be talking about the Tavistock Institute, and I've called it Reviving Task, the notion of task, from the Tavistock Institute archives. And Tavistock was not exactly the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations, are not always included in the contingency theory gang, but were very much inspirational for a lot of the contingency theories and shared a lot of the assumptions about that there is no one best way of organizing, that very much importantly, it depends on the task for which you organize. Something that I believe that organization and management theory has very much forgotten these days, because we somehow skip over a more precise understanding of the task at hand for which an organization or a network organizes. I will hope to have the chance to invite you to revisit the Tavistock archives to understand and learn how much they actually have as a resource for understanding better the challenges, the demands of the task to organization. It's also an example, as Sarah explained about Joan Woodward, that the Tavistock people were very much engaged in also organizing society, helping out after the Second World War, raising Europe, again, getting back to understanding how come that organization may evolve in a certain unforeseen manner, an unfortunate manner, and how can we be better understanding the task requirements, but also the anxieties that play a role in the way that organization function. The Tavistock Institute of Human Relations were established in 1947 in Tavistock, UK, and closely related to the Tavistock Clinic, which played a key role in the British Army psychiatry. A number of projects during the 40s, 50s, and 60s were focusing on the group relations and the way you could organize best way according to the task. And these were very much live experiments. The Northfield experiments at where Bion conducted a lot of psychiatric experiments, or group relation experiments. The Calico Mills in Ahmedabad, the coal mine studies, which was very much the case for the development of socio-technical systems theory. The Glacier Metal Company, a live experiment, a naturally occurring experiment where both Elliot Jakes and Wilfred Brown were managing directors and researchers. And also the Pethick Hospital study, where Isabel Menzies-Leith did a lot of a study of the way nurses organized the clinical work. And the concepts of assumptions that are characterizing the Tavistock School is that individuals, groups, institutions are systems with an internal and an external environment. Organization and management should focus on the transaction across the boundaries between the systems inside and outside. And the primary tasks, because sometimes there are more than one, is the focal point to understand the transaction across the systems inside and outside. You have to organize for the task so that you best, the best way to organize is to make sure that the task in its specificity and its entirety, the whole task is taken care for. But the task requirements are not always aligned with human needs, and that the organizational challenge, the organizational issue is to balance the requirements stemming from the task with the human relations. They developed a lot of models that focused on what they called the task system versus the sentient system, which was very much the feelings, the emotions, the sentiments that people have in an organization and that are associated with this or that particular task. And this is something that is, I feel today, has been actually forgotten, that we now study emotions in organizations without connecting them to the task and realizing that a lot of anxieties and tensions in organizations are actually stemming from the task and related to the task. And that a very crucial point of organizing is to understand how we both cater for the task and cater for those emotions that the task invoke in people. And there are a lot of models. This is just two examples of the way that work groups may develop certain basic anxieties, basic assumptions about the task that hinder them solving the task, actually. And that the task may also have requirements from the outside that also that influences the way that task can actually be handled. On the other, to the right side, there is also the way you can think about one person's role in an organization, that a person has a task, but he or her also has an emotional system around that. And these things do sometimes coincide, and sometimes they are apart, so that sometimes people have an understanding of their task that they don't share themselves, or that they don't emotionally share, and that make it difficult for them to actually solve the task. And sometimes people tend to conflate the two things so that we only solve the task that we like and forget about those that we don't like. And so there are a lot of dynamics going on in organizations about the way we actually understand the task in its wholeness. A completely classic study is the study in the coal mines made by Tristan Bamford about the way that the coal mining technology changed from being a handguard method, which was very much working in groups, small groups that helped each other getting the coals. And then you introduced the longwall technology that after which coal getting was becoming much more efficient, but it also undermined the social structure of the coal getters so that they become overwhelmed with the anxieties because they no longer could have the small support of a small team. And therefore, a lot of controversies, a lot of morale problems emerged with these changes in technology. And it is a good example of the way the task also put on certain anxieties that you have to cater for in order to fulfill it, and that changes in technology will sometimes change also the emotional system around the task. Another example is taken from Miller and Rice's study, which I really can recommend revisiting. There's a lot of interesting studies also about research organization, where also the sentiments associated with doing research, very much people like us, that we are also sometimes having different types of emotions, different types of anxieties, own ambitions that are not easily compatible with the organizational purpose of doing research. There's an excellent study of dry cleaning and of airlines that I've just shown here, that to run an airline is very much about bringing together the task of carrying passengers from one place to the other, that it encompasses a multiplicity of tasks, separate tasks that has to come together. And there's, I really recommend reading it again today. It's really the same that goes on still in airlines, to make the ground system work together with the flying system. It's two completely different organizations to handle luggage and get people buying their flight. And then when people are shepherding people into the airlines and taking care of them while flying, a lot of anxieties, a lot of tensions, a lot of things you have to think about. And that complicates the way you can organize an airline system. I want to also take this opportunity to say that getting back to the task is, I think, very much something that organization theory should take upon itself. Because in practical organization, those that also happens to practically manage something knows that it's very important to actually understand what task you are managing and how to get people to understand that task or that purpose. But also in theories of organization, as a core concern to any organization and manager, as a top three contingency factor. That means that depending on the task, you should organize in this or the other way. Something I feel that organization theory has somehow come to forget in its preference for flat organizations or bossless organizations. Well, sometimes it's fitting the task and sometimes it's utterly unfitting the task, creating a lot of emotional anxieties in so-called self-management teams. I recommend really getting back to understanding the specific task as a mode of inquiry before discussing how to organize and what kind of organization you would prefer. And as a way of what I call anchoring the organizational reality, for which reality are you organizing? And I just found it curious that if you go back also to a lot of text of that age, even though they're not signing up under the contingency banner, they kind of repeat also the importance of knowing what you're doing. The first thing from Drucker, what is our business? It is as important a question in a business that appears to have little control over what it produces physically, a copper mine, for instance, or a steel mill, as in a business such as a retail store or an insurance company that seems to have a great deal of control. And today we come kind of thinks that everybody can manage whatever, that they don't need to be particularly well into the task to manage like an organization. I feel that is something that we have to get back to understanding the difficulties in. Know what you're doing, whether one chooses to count spines, charge spine counters or fish. It's still good to know what you're doing. And this holds true for inquiry in general, as well as for specific inquiries concerning organizational behavior. And finally, it was the genius of the Tavistock workers to combine a knowledge of therapy with a knowledge of the social psychology and sociology of organizations. So to understand how to people work in organizations and the way you can cater for a task, you also need to understand the anxieties associated with the task and how you can contain them as a management system. Thank you.
Okay, let me start by thanking Greta and Pedro for the invitation. I was invited even last year, but I had to cancel at the very last minute. So it's very nice to be here, and I'm glad to present my thoughts on Organizations in Action by James Thompson. It was nice to reread this masterpiece or classic book in organizational theory for the 10th time, I guess. But it's actually quite an interesting experience to go back to this book because it's really a source of inspiration. I mean, there are obviously limitations. I mean, there are things that we don't necessarily find convincing nowadays. But I mean, if you go back and you reread some of the parts of this book, I mean, it's truly inspirational. Let me go through some of the key ideas of Thompson, and then I want to try to convince you that this book really anticipates some of the debates or some of the themes that we are even nowadays doing research on. By the way, this James Thompson was a key figure in the 60s. He was not only the author of this interesting book, but also the founder of ASQ and the first editor of ASQ. Unfortunately, like John Woodward, died prematurely of cancer at age 50, 51. The book is a classic book. I mean, the impact has been, I mean, it's still enduring. I mean, if you look at Google Scholar, every single day you have more citations. That number is not the current number. This morning was greater than that. And it's truly a generative book. It has 95 propositions. And if you read them, some of them are truly hypotheses that you could test. So it's truly inspirational at multiple levels. The theoretical foundation, I mean, and I kind of agree with framing his work within the context of contingency theory, but I think one of the strengths of this book is to span boundaries. It would be really limiting if we wouldn't make justice to his contribution to treat this book as an exemplar of contingency theory. If you go back at the theoretical foundation, clearly it builds upon contingency theory and actually develops contingency arguments, but this book borrows heavily from Simon's notion of boundary rationality. It borrows heavily from the behavioral theory of the firm. It borrows heavily from Emerson's classic paper, 62 paper on power and dependence. And those concepts are integrated very nicely to talk about how firms behave and respond to contingencies and trying to deal with constraints from the environment. Truly a multidisciplinary book, and I think for people that are interested in categories, you probably see in this book a good example of how spanning boundaries, spanning categorical boundaries, actually pays off. It's not stigmatized. Okay. I think that the key question, a very simple question, in many ways a deceptively simple question that Thompson tries to address in this book is, we know that organizations act, but what determines how and when they will act? He has a very interesting structure in his book. The first part of the book is purely devoted to what he calls impersonal forces, which essentially affect the way organizations, behave. And he explicitly says, I want to put aside personality in this part of the book, because that would create all kinds of theoretical challenges. And essentially, this is probably the most, as you say, the part of the book that is more consistent with a contingency approach. You can argue that at the end of the day, most of his propositions that crystallize his theoretical insight are trying to show how organizations that face very similar environmental conditions behave very similarly. Although my making this statement, I would probably trivialize a little bit his contribution, because if you read this part of the book carefully and you look at some of the propositions, you will see the variety of strategies that organizations can deploy in order to shape the environment. And after reading the second part, you will actually appreciate the implicit recognition that firms, organizations facing the same environmental conditions might actually come up with different ways, different strategies, in other words, to deal with the environment. So it's not necessarily true that you observe organizations responding or adopting similar strategies to deal with the environment, even when they face the same conditions. There is still a possibility for heterogeneity in the way they act. So the second part of the book is indeed laying out the foundations for what essentially is administrative discretion. And this is not just at the level of top management. Actually, he actually has a very holistic notion of administration that goes from what he calls the institutional level, which would be the top management, to the intermediate management, what he calls the organizational level, and then the technical level, basically people, if you wish, on the shop floor. Okay, those who are essentially running the operations of the organization. And implicit, there is a strong emphasis on the role of the middle management as a translator between the two levels, between the operational, the technical, and the institutional or top management. The important point here is that the emphasis that Thompson places on the role of discretion in many ways allows for heterogeneity in organizational behavior, even when they face very similar conditions. Okay, so that is in a way consistent but inconsistent with the contingency argument, and kind of paves the way for, I believe, interesting developments that in organizational theory, also I would say in strategy. Okay, nowadays we talk a lot about shaping the environment and each creation, enactment or effectuation. I think that it doesn't fully develop some of this insight, but the seeds of some of these ideas are clearly evident in some of these arguments, at least at the theoretical level, okay, and in some of these propositions. Let me skip a little bit the core argument. I assume that most of you are familiar with his work. If you're not, it's your problem, which means that it's a good opportunity for you to read carefully the book. But essentially, trying to understand how firms cope with the uncertainties from the environment and the kind of technologies that they use. And the central, one of the key conceptual contribution in his work is this idea of task environment. The task environment, if you wish, is a subset of the larger environment, which is the most relevant environment for the organization, from which essentially the organization gets inputs and to which the organization brings whatever outputs the organization creates. The important thing here in the task environment is the complexity of the task environment. It's not just customers, it's not just suppliers, it's also other competitors. It's also, if you want to use the institutional language, is the institutional environment. Okay, and essentially the organization's survival, long-term survival, depends on its ability to really engage, let's say, in a conversation with each one of these different actors. And it's not just fortified forces, although there are some elements of that, it's mostly an institutional, broader institutional understanding of what the environment looks like. And you can see how by focusing on some of these actors, many important subsequent discussions have been already kind of previewed in his paper, in his book, sorry. I want to just share with you a few themes that, in my opinion, are kind of sort of anticipated more or less clearly in his book. One is the idea that the boundaries between the organizations and the task environment are not given, are not fixed, are not exogenous. It's actually a decision variable. Essentially, the organization is always trying to redefine these boundaries, and the boundary redefinition is essentially an attempt of the organization to reduce its dependence on the environment. If you look at the citations, he never cite Coase, although the 37 paper by Coase was there. But if you go back to Coase, even before he start talking about explicit about transaction cost, there are similar arguments about boundaries, organizational boundaries. Even for Coase, organizational boundaries are a decision variable. The other important thing that is a direct derivation of his notion of task environment is that he's really thinking about organizations dealing with multiple stakeholders. I mean, nowadays we talk a lot about non-market strategy, about stakeholders' view, but I mean, essentially, Thompson's book is how you deal with multiple stakeholders, not just one single type of stakeholder. And that, by the way, it's not by chance that if you go back to resource dependence theory, one of the key foundational contributions is Thompson's book, okay? The other important theme that he sort of anticipates is the notion of adapting versus shaping. Thompson's conceptualization, organizations are not simply adapting to the environment or trying to react to contingencies or constraints. This is probably the one version of the contingency view. It's really thinking about how can I manipulate some of the strategic variables that I can control. All of his book is about how can I shape, to some extent, the environment, not simply be shaped by the environment, okay? And the other important thing is which is actually very clear in the second part of his book, is the recognition of the role of human agency. The idea of discretion is clearly consistent with the recognition that individuals, the decision makers in the organizations, are critical to understand how firms decide to deal with constraints and essentially overcome contingencies. He actually explicitly acknowledged the importance of human perceptions and how that eventually affects the kind of response or the kind of strategy that organizations adopt, even when they face similar conditions. So in a way that allows for heterogeneity in organizational behavior. By the way, this is another interesting passage from the second part of his book, where he really talks about administration can innovate. So essentially, decision makers at different levels can try to leverage or at least act upon strategic variables to shape the environment. It's not simply being shaped by the environment. I'm not arguing that Thompson is promoting or advocating a constructivist approach. There is no notion of enactment, okay? It's still, to a large extent, a positivist, okay? There is a reality out there, but I can try to shape it, okay? I'm not enacting that reality. There are obviously books like papers that are popular best sellers, but here today, but forgotten tomorrow. And I think there are, on the contrary, books or papers, books in this place, that are classics or best sellers in the long run. Obviously, only classic papers or classic books like Thompson books achieve consecration at the end. Everybody prays classic, but only a few really read them. So I think that unfortunately, what happens sometimes with this book is a lot of people cite them or don't even cite them, but they don't read them. And that is really a pity. So it's great that this episode is actually resurrecting some of these fantastic books. Thanks so much.
And that is all for episode 58. From the second edition of the Professional Development Workshop, Classics of Organization and Management Theory, which focus on the contingency approach. For more details, including an information sheet about the authors discussed at the workshop, please visit www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. And please join us next week in the Talking About Organizations podcast.